if you did, to the front cover page, the Christian Story: A Journey Through Time, Understanding the Origins and Developments of Christian Thought, and that's certainly our goal. I'll give you an introduction to councils, doctrines, crusades, Inquisition, papacy. Of course, you know what the word papacy refers to? The Pope and that whole papacy concept of archaism is a thing for rule, and Pope rule is papacy. Transubstantiation, Trinity, Incarnation. And of course, Trinity and Incarnation is something we started with. The church doesn't get to those real concepts for a couple of hundred years, maybe three, even up. One of the major councils, and a council is when you convene a bunch of the leading priests and all those people to a particular location. But Trinity and Incarnation are terms that come later, much later. Do you know what the word orthodoxy means? Orthodox?
Same.
Yeah. It's same thinking. Well, ortho is right doctrine. Okay. Well, we will be comparing what is declared to be the orthodox teaching as opposed to heretical teaching. Heretic, orthodox. And orthodox is we are the ones that have it right. Orthodoxy is right doctrine, right teaching, right understanding, that kind of a concept. Orthopraxy, P-R-A-X-Y, is right living, right action. And when you go through church history, they'll beat the drum always over orthodoxy, seldom over orthopraxy. And it should be reversed. Occasionally, it's action, right action. You know, it's the straight action, it's straight right, the right doing, that kind of thing. Ortho, O-R-T-H-O-P-R-A-X-Y is the way it's referred to. Now, there'll be some, along the path, you'll find that some priests are excommunicated. And do you know the word ex means out, community, out of the community, declared to not be part of the faith now. And some of them for immoral behavior. That'll occur occasionally. But it's not that's not the thing that, you know, guides the ship. It's the way you believe is more important than the way you do. Infant versus believer's baptism, you know, the Anabaptists got killed for that. And we'll follow the life of the church through persecution. And persecution lasted how many hundred years? Approximately 3. Yeah. About 325 is a pivotal date. That's when Constantine, legalized Christianity. So at 325, you start privilege. Now you think about how the years of persecution lasted 100 years more than our country. You know, we're on the other side of 200 years. In our country, and we'd have another 100 years to go, and we think that we're the major cog in the scheme of church history, and we don't comprise a very very big part of that at all. I mean, whenever you think that nothing was done to redirect that long period of persecution. Now, persecution during that 300 years was more intermittent than continuous. It was not continuous. There were times whenever it would be very, very, very severe. Feed them to the lions. You know, Nero in 64 did about as heinous persecution as anybody. He blamed the fire on the Christians, and then he would paint them with tar and light his orgies and that sort of thing. He did some pretty harsh things. But then there'll be later, and we'll have one night where we'll just look at some of these rulers and the kind of persecution they went through. But we've got to think in terms of, I think Bill was telling me that in Europe, they think of a building being old if it's at least...
In England, 1,000 years.
1,000 years old. Well, we think of a building being old if it's... 30, you know, 40, you know, that's a 40-year-old house, you know, what do you expect? They ought to be rotten down by now. Well, you know, you travel around Europe, you know, 1,000 years for a house, you know. I remember as a kid, this guy in my community decided when Jesus comes back and reigns on the earth for 1,000 years, he needed somewhere to live, so he said, there's no house here that will last 1,000 years. He hadn't been to Europe, but anyhow, he built this, the rock house. And he believed, as long as he believed in that this is the house that Jesus would live in to do his rule, that he'd live forever. Well, they buried him underneath that house, you know. And, but it's still there. It's a monument. But we got to, it's, okay, persecution to privilege there, and then dominance. And in the period of dominance is when the papacy has more authority, more power than the emperor. Then decline. Things start falling off. And now we are living in the period of what's called uncertainty. Now, go to the second page. Roman Empire about A.D. 150. So we're just, you know, we're really 100 years after Christ. This is what would be the Roman Empire. Mediterranean Sea, North Africa, Hippo, Carthage. You see those two places there, Hippo and Carthage. Right above the word Africa. Those are prominent centers. Carthage and Hippo in Africa are prominent centers. If you swing on, if you go east to your right, north of the word Egypt, you see Alexandria. Alexandria, major prominent center for Christianity. Then you swing right along through Jamnia, Caesarea, which would be and then right around, and Jerusalem would be right in there. And go on up north to Antioch. Antioch is a major Christian center. And then if you swing on around the Med, where you see the word Byzantium, is that right?
Byzantium, I might be wrong.
Byzantium, okay. Anyhow, that would be Constantinople, which becomes a major center. If the Black Sea, north of the Black Sea, will become Eastern Orthodoxy. They'll move in that direction. But at one point, the Roman Church was centered in the capital city of Rome, and it spent a period there in Constantinople. Now, you swing on around, and of course, Rome is a major center, and then Spain. And Gaul would be what's country today?
France.
And then you go on up to Germany above that. And but that's, you know, when you think of the Roman Empire, that's quite an expanse there. And people say that Jesus comes to the earth at a time when the spread of his message was at its optimum position, meaning that all the way around the Mediterranean, one power ruled. Alexander the Great came along before Jesus, and he was a Greek ruler, and he what they call Hellenized the world, meaning he tried to give the whole world one language, which it would be Greek. Our New Testament written in Greek. And so all around the Med, because of Alexander and now of Rome, then you have this language opportunity, like in the world today, English has the same power in the world. And then at this particular time, they call it the Roman Pax, P-A-X, it's Roman peace. They had built roads and transportation, and so it was at a major time. Okay, now drop down. To the little map that just has names on it. Hippo and Carthage of North Africa, Alexandria and Egypt swinging around, Antioch. Remember, Antioch is where Barnabas was Barnabas, and there began to be a big Christian movement at Antioch, and he went and found Paul, brought him to Antioch, and then they would leave from Antioch and go to that little island at Cyprus right there, right out off the coast, and swing over toward Asia Minor, and that's where he did his missionary journeys. Now, Constantinople, you see it's up there at the top, Chalcedon, Nicaea, that's where the councils were, those the important church councils are. And of course Rome, and then my French is not very good, so is Lyons, is that Lyon? Okay. And the other place, there's a major Milan, M-I-L-A-N. There's a major event happened there. We'll talk about that. Okay. Now slide off to the right there. Major church councils. The Council of Nicaea, 325. The issue before the council was, is Christ fully divine? Okay. That's where, is God and Christ of the same substance, or are they like each other? You know, he's like, or is he of the same? You know, it's, there's one Greek word, homoousios, and homoousios. Yeah. The difference is there's an I in the middle of one and not the other. And it's like homogenized means homogenized milk. It's all stirred up. Yeah, it's all same. Okay. And so that's what they were trying to get. You know, there had been a controversy by the man by the name of Arius who said Jesus was begotten, so he was born. Created, he wasn't. He's the son, so he's less than, and on went. And so they've been fighting with that. And then at Constantinople, which Nicaea is 325, Constantinople is 381. Another 60 years. About is Christ fully human? Now we're talking about the incarnation. You know. Is Christ fully divine? That's a piece of what doctrine? Is Christ fully divine? That's part of the Trinity. You know, is he, are they three in one? You know, that kind of thing. At Constantinople, does he incarnate? Does he only appear to have a body? Did he really have a body? You know, because of the Gnostic, controversies and all that around, is he a unified person? 431. Christ is human and divine in one person. The Council of Chalcedon is in 451. Okay. Now, swing past the divider and go to page one. I engineered Caroline to put these booklets together for me this last week, and I finally was wise enough to tell her the number of the pages so I could identify which page we were on. Okay. Now, in this booklet, I put a lot of pieces together, some of which we've covered in individual sessions before. I put them together because I want you to have them all in one place so you can pick them up and pull them together again. Now, when you look at our timeline up here that we've been looking at, persecution 325, then privilege, this is after Nicaea, Constantine. As you move on this way, this is this period of privilege. And then and this block in here is when the Roman Catholicism dominates. And then the decline of Roman Catholicism happens coincident with, obviously, the Reformation taking out a big swath of the people. And, okay, timeline 325 is Constantine. 600 AD is when Mohammed and Islam is birthed. 1000 AD is whenever Catholicism, we call it Catholic because the word Catholic means universal. But they finally decided we're not universal because we can't agree. And we can't agree on things like the nature of Christ. We can't agree on things like Catholicism said We need to celebrate resurrection on what day of the week? What? We're going to do it on Sunday, okay? Well, the other group said no. You know, we should do it coincident with what Jewish celebration? Passover. Passover. And so the Passover is the 14th of Nisan. It's, and so it'll happen on a different day of the week every year, you know, I mean, but we know that Passover was what, you know, that was the season, that was the time, and that's whenever Jesus had the I wanted to, eat this Passover with you, go and prepare. Okay. So we don't have any question about when that happened. Okay. We know the date, but the church is saying, we have now sanctified Sunday, so therefore that's when we ought to celebrate. And so they couldn't agree, wrestle through with that and that sort of thing. But several other things. Just like one group said that there's one standard for priests and there's one standard for laity. Priests are closer to God than laity, so they have stricter standards. Therefore, priests have to be males like they were of Jews. That, I guess they have female priests now. Have they ever broken that barrier? Okay. But priests could not marry. Well, that one group says, you know, Peter was married. You know, how do we know Peter was married? Had a mother-in-law. That's one of the miracles that Jesus healed his mother-in-law. They were at Peter's house and his mother-in-law was sick and he healed her and she got up and served him, the meal. You know, and they were saying, and so they wrestled back and forth on that. And so, you know, the people that go to Constantinople and eventually are pushed on into Russia are called Eastern Orthodox. Okay. The Eastern brand of what's right. Okay. The Western brand, we call the West centering around, Rome. And the East, way over here on the Med, is the division. So there was a major split between Western and Eastern Orthodoxy. Rome is saying, this is what's right. And the other group is saying, no, we don't agree. So in Eastern Orthodoxy, you can get married if you're a priest. You can, we'll celebrate, resurrection on the right day of the month. And various other differences that they had a little nuance of difference in the Lord's table. We'll look at that sometime when we get there. But they're the people that when you see them on television, they wear the funky looking pointed hats, you know, and then they also wear a beard. Okay. And of course, the Amish wear beards, but some of them don't wear the mustache, you know, whatever, you know. So, but anyhow, that the decision about what's the right thing, you know, had a major split there, Eastern, Western Orthodoxy. Then, of course, at the Reformation, a lot of these concepts, transubstantiation is wrestled with, baptism and salvation by works. At the Reformation, penance, purgatory, those kind of concepts were major on the table. You know, you don't buy your way in by buying relics or paying priests to pray prayers. You don't get yourself out of purgatory. And so, and at this point, all the way from here all the way to here, Catholicism had carried the apocryphal books. There's about 11 of those. There's a section of books, we call them the apocryphal books, and that's where they get purgatory, in that section. And the Jews never carried the apocryphal books as part of the Old Testament. They were written during that intertestamental period, what we call the close of Malachi would have been 300 years before Jesus. And there were no other prophets between Malachi and Jesus. And so Jews don't pick up any books. But the apocryphal books were written during that period. Now, early Christianity picked them up, and this is where they got introduced. There was a need because of Alexander's work, there's a need to get the Old Testament into the Greek language, and we call that translation Septuagint, because of LXX is 70
scholars.
70 scholars were assigned the task to translate the Old Testament into Greek, and the legend was that they all went into separate places and translated it and came back and had one exact copy. That's the legend. But they included the Apocrypha as part of the Septuagint, and then when it was picked up in Christianity, then it was just picked up. Let me do this real quick here if I can. I put this timeline down of the Old Testament for you. Now, let me tell you that the dating for Abraham, which I have on my timeline to be about 1700, the dating for the Exodus 1225, and then the conquest on over to the monarchy. The monarchy is the rule of one. The first king was Saul. Saul, the next one was David. Saul, David, Solomon, and then the kingdom split, north and south, Rehoboam, Jeroboam. Now, there is little controversy over 1000 B.C. being the date for David. It's about 1050. So you always think of David being about 1,000 years before Christ. Okay. Now, the date of the Exodus and Abraham vary between scholars as much as 200 to 250 years. Okay. And that stems from, in the book of Kings and Chronicles, it says there was 480 years, 480 years between Abraham and the Exodus. And what I'm trying to say to you is when you see a timeline, it may have 1700 for Abraham or about 19 to 2000 for Abraham. Understand that stems off the controversy of how to interpret that passage in Kings. I'll bring you the exact passage, but 480 years, there were supposed to be 12 generations between Abraham and Moses, okay? And so the guy writing thought 40 years per 12 generation, that's 480 years. Well, actually, it worked out to be more like 25 years. And anyhow, so it shifts back and forth. Some people say, but that's not the point I want to make here. Now, look, the interval of time is the same. Abraham to the Exodus, you know, there's about 500 years there because we're 400 years in slavery, right? Then from Exodus to the, when we leave Egypt, and then to the time we're going to set up the king rule by Saul and David, there's about 200 years that transpires. Now, that's an interval of time equal to our own history of our own country. Once again, you know, we think of reading our Old Testament and think in terms of weeks and months. But, you know, from Moses to David, this is the time spent of our own country. From David to the fall of the Northern Empire, about the time of our own country. From the fall of the Northern Empire to the fall of the Southern Empire is about the length of our country. And you know, on it goes. So for 200 or 300 years to pass, it's kind of like nothing on the calendar that, you know, as God's dealing with things. You know, the prophets, okay, Isaiah and some of those guys at the front here, Elijah, Isaiah, those guys at the front, we call them 8th century prophets. Well, they're about 200 years, for 200 years between Isaiah and the Babylonian captivity, God sent prophets like Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, Joel, you know, on the ghost. But what I'm saying, Israel was off base, going in the wrong direction. God would send a prophet. And for how long did he send prophets before he finally said, well, this isn't working. They got to go out to captivity. How long would he do that? 200 years. I mean, so when we think about the persecution lasted 300 years, well, that's still that block of time, 200 or 300 years. God's saying, okay, we're going to, you know, so I wanted to put this up on your calendar mind so that you could, that historical sketch of biblical history down at the bottom, you see that shift and change. Like when Israel comes out of Babylonian captivity until the time of Christ, it's about 300 years. You know, once again, 200 or 300 years between a major event and a major event. We think in terms of our 50-year-old house. Okay. Now, turn to page 2. Now, all right, I'm going to slow down just a little bit because I won't be able to talk tomorrow. I've been riding a tractor for 3 days and eating dust, and so my throat's already at its max. And I'm trying to give you all I can in a quick time. Okay. I will keep coming back and overlapping this stuff so that when we're finished, I can throw this timeline up here and you're going to be able to say, boom, 325, big date, boom, you know, 1,000, big date, 1,500, it's a big date. And then, you know, 1,800, big date, we start the new adventure in Christianity in America. And on goes those dates, 450 Chalcedon. You know, these dates will just become real familiar to you. And you'll know persecution to privilege, to dominance, to what comes after dominance? Decline.
Decline and
uncertainty. See, we're living in that period of Christianity right now. What does it mean to be a Christian? Look at the landscape. You know, I mean, you know, what is Orthodox belief right now? You know, you can believe anything and everything. What is orthopraxy? What is the right behavior? Well, you can be homosexual and pastor a church. You can, what, you know, so things have, you know, you talk about uncertainty. You know, that Gallup poll I was telling you about after the election, they had the categories for Christianity is evangelical Christians. Evangelical Christian, but not born again. And, notional Christians. Now, I don't know what a notional Christian, I got a notion this thing might be right or something, I don't know, but, you know, evangelical means you believe in the authority of the scriptures, you believe in a spiritual event of rebirth, that's what an evangelical is. They believe in being missionary minded in terms of winning the lost and that sort of thing. That's what an evangelical born again. There's a group of people says we're evangelical, but we're not born again. Now, how do you get into the book of John and not walk out with, you know, we're born of the Spirit? You know, Jesus, the direct conversation with Nicodemus, marvel not, I say to you, you must be born again. And unless you're born again, you will not see the kingdom of heaven. Well, that's pretty plain. It's pretty direct. And then you walk through the Apostle Paul and all of the spiritual indwelling. You know, we're no longer just ordinary people. We are spiritual people. I couldn't address you as a mature spiritual people, but as babies because you haven't let this thing develop in you. Well, the point being is, here's a group of people that says, you know, Chuck Colson, after his prison episode, he came out with the book, Born Again. And, you know, of course, because of his notoriety, a lot of people are reading it. And they said, what in the world is this guy talking about? Born again. This is stupid. This is nonsense. You just believe in God and try to be nice and go to church and put a little money in the plate. That's Christianity. And Colson was saying, man, I've had a conversion experience when I, you know, my life has been changed. There's something that's happened that was different. But to think that people were saying you can be a Christian, but we're going to change the standard. Okay. That sort of thing. Now, when I was growing up, brand new subject. When I was growing up, I often wondered where the Bible came from. No one ever, no church I was a part of ever knew enough to teach us where it came from, how it all happened and all that sort of thing. All I know is somebody handed me this book and said, this is God's book. And then the first time somebody tried to hand me a Mormon book, they said, this is God's book. And I said, wait a minute, I thought I already had God's book. No, there's been an update here, a new edition. And I thought, well, okay, what's the deal here, you know? And then I got to thinking, well, if there's more than one book out there that's called the God book, then I bumped into the Quran, and it's a God book. And you know, everybody's saying they got a God book, you know? And I thought, well, we got all these books, and maybe all this religion is just ideas that somebody put on a piece of paper, and they tell me the event that this thing describes over 2,000 years ago, and I said, how do I know that this thing ever, if there is any historical credibility to this guy called Jesus? Is there any historical credibility? I mean, we know that Aristotle and Plato, What are they about 200-300 BC, somewhere around in there? Okay, but we know those guys existed historically. They're not a figment of someone's imagination. And I said, well, what about Jesus? Do we have anything that would say, you know, at least I know that historically there was a guy called Jesus. I mean, there's historical evidence that there was a guy called Jesus of Nazareth, and he got crucified. You know, now. Whether he raised from the dead or not, that's up for discussion. But you know, I wanted a historical root to this whole thing that was going on. I wasn't just I believe in God because the book tells me to. You know, what how do I do that? So I want you to know that there is, this period right here, this first 300 years, is going to take us longer than the subsequent years. Because so much happens during the first 300 years. You got to hammer the faith out during that time. Try and figure out whether Jesus is divine, whether he is fully man, fully God, whether he is of the same substance of God, or whether he is a created being. And only, you know, they didn't have these questions at first because they were so overwhelmed with the resurrection. They had more than they could grab a hold of. You know, they experienced the resurrected Lord. And then you have the next generation that held hands with those who were eyewitnesses of the resurrection. So the power of that was strong. The next generation is like Gail. She talked with her grandma, whose grandpa fought in the Civil War. Now, I mean, we're, you know, with one person in between, we're connected all the way back to the Civil War. I don't have to say, well, was the Civil War a figment of, you know, just a storybook idea? Well, you know, I talked to the person who talked to the man who was in the war. Okay. He came back. In fact, when he the guy that saw the war, broke his leg in the Civil War. Wasn't that the guy? You don't remember? Okay. I used to, anyhow, Mamma Acres. But see, I know Mamma Acres, who knew her papa, who fought in the Civil War. So we're connected. You know, what's that? I mean, my goodness, what, 140 years? You know, we're pushing 150, 200 years, you know. So if I could get some of those kinds of, so up through here, on up to about 200 or so AD, you only got one person standing between me and Christ. See? And so I want to know who these people are, what they're talking about, And that gives a historicity to this thing. It's not some story that somebody came up with, like the guy in the cave in the Mormon book. You know, he just goes in the cave and the angel interprets some gold plates to him. And I'm saying, you know, man, that's got no foundation, not something I want to lay my life on. There is a ton of stuff in here as they're trying to develop the faith and that sort of thing. And guess what? If all of it is written by Christians, what will we say? If all that information is written by Christians, we would say they're prejudiced, right? They are establishing something on the basis of what they already believe and trying to put validity to it and that sort of thing. Okay, in this section of material that's here, what I want to demonstrate to you is that the people outside the faith were writing about Christianity, real historical Christianity. And even those who were persecuting the Christians were validating the whole historicity of that particular movement and group, okay? You know, that it's a real movement and things are happening. So, now, here's a guy, Thallus, who's writing about AD 52. How long after Jesus? 20 years. 20 years. Right around 20 years. I can remember something 20 years ago. I mean, I've been 40 years since I'm in Vietnam. I can give you a pretty detailed story of that. That's 40 years ago. So for me, Julius Africanus, quotes Thallus, and he says, Thallus in the third book of his histories explains away this darkness that accompanied the crucifixion as an eclipse of the sun, unreasonably as it seems to me. His argument is that Thallus' explanation is unreasonable because a solar eclipse could not occur at the time of the Paschal full moon Passover. Now, the point of that is Thallus, writing at 52, is trying to explain what happened to Jesus while he's on the cross. And what happened to Jesus while he's on the cross? The darkness. And he said it was an nothing really supernatural happened. It was just an eclipse of the sun, just a natural phenomenon. And this guy, Julius Africanus, says you can't have an eclipse at the time of Passover. It ain't going to happen. I mean, those who do astronomy can tell you that. I'd have to depend on them telling me why. But anyhow, the point being is, see, Thallus was trying to say the event, even this minor point, and it's a minor point, did the sky actually go dark while Jesus was on the cross? Now that's a minor detail. It's probably in only one of the Gospels. And here this guy is saying, let me show you how these Christians he had this event that happened in his own lifetime. You know, Thallus would have been alive. And he said, oh, it was just an eclipse. No, it was the act of God. Well, and even though he tried, so see how that, the guy who's trying to put Christianity down winds up, you know, giving validity to that event occurred because he's trying to explain it away by a different means. Okay, now go to, you're familiar with Josephus, not the guy that drinks liquor and plays the guitar, that's Bosephus, isn't it? That's not Josephus. Not Bosephus. Okay. Yeah. Now, he lived between 37 and 100. So he was born about the time of these things that went on with Christ. The event would already take place. He's a Jewish historian who became a Pharisee at the age of 19. And that's clocking. You know, he's served as commander of Jewish forces in Galilee, captured by the Romans in AD 66. Now you realize that we're pushing what pivotal date, AD 70. What happened AD 70? Jerusalem destroyed by the Romans. Well, that they laid siege to the city for about 3 or 4 years. And so he was captured in AD 66, attached to the Roman headquarters. And then he wrote his work called The Antiquities of the Jews, AD 75-85. Now, Josephus is a Jew. He's captured, taken to Rome, and he decides get along instead of fight. So he's attached to the Roman to Rome, and he's asked to write a history of the Jews for the Romans. Now here's a history of the Jews that's not written for religious purposes. It's not written to educate the Jews of their history. It's you know, Rome's interested in histories and all that kind of stuff, and ask him to write what we would call a secular historical history book, the events of the Jews. And he, and here's the quote. At this time, of course, among the Jews, not all of them considered Jesus to be the Messiah. They considered him to be just a man. Okay. At this time, there was a wise man in his antiquities. He's up to this point of Jesus. He was called Jesus. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. And those who became his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, that he was alive. Accordingly, he was, perhaps, the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. Now, what is Josephus saying? This event happened. Here's a guy writing Antiquities of the Jews. Pilate condemned Jesus to be crucified. Now, he's put a line in there identifying a Roman leader with an action he took. If it was fabricated, what would happen? They would know immediately. In fact, he's writing in a period of time that's only 34 years after it. If Pilate hadn't done this and this thing hadn't happened, you know, so you see the historicity. It's nailed down outside of Christianity. Here's Cornelius Tacitus, page 3. Here's a Roman historian. He's writing A.D. 112. Now, that's 80 years out. He was 60 years old. He was governor of Asia. He writes concerning the history of Nero. He wrote of Nero's attempt to relieve himself of the guilt of burning Rome and alludes to the death of Christ and to the existence of Christians in Rome. Quotation. To suppress the rumor of his being responsible for the burning Rome, Nero being responsible, he falsely charged with guilt and punished with most exquisite tortures the persons commonly called Christians, who were hated for their enormities. And many times in history, they refer to Christ as Christus. Christus, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the region of Tiberias. That sounds just like Luke, doesn't it? In the region of Tiberias. But the pernicious superstition repressed for a time, now he calls Christianity a superstition, broke out again, not only through Judea where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome itself. Now here's a Roman historian writing and saying Jesus was put to death by Pontius Pilate. It's reported that he raised from the dead. He can't, you know, doesn't verify that, but it demonstrates that even people outside the faith knew of the death of Jesus and this possible resurrection event. Okay. Suetonius, court official under Hadrian, written about 120. As the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Chestus, Christ, variant spelling of Christ, Nero expelled them from Rome. Punishment by Nero was inflicted on Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. It doesn't matter that he speaks not kindly of Christian faith. What matters is that you have someone who is a Roman, who's not a Christian at all, who is writing history and is setting all this down and saying these are the events that occurred. Now, and so it gives you strength there. Son, Pliny, the younger, the son of Roman naturalist Pliny the Elder, who was killed investigating the Vesuvius volcano, governor of Bithynia, where he says, we have 10 volumes of his writing written about 120 A.D., and they're still in existence today. In the 10th volume, he wrote to the Emperor Trajan. Now, here he's writing to Trajan about how he killed many Christians, men, women, and children. he said that he attempted to make them curse the name of Christ, which a genuine Christian cannot be induced to do. Now, what he's saying there is, I know I get the right ones who really are Christians, because you can't make a Christian curse Christ. Isn't that powerful? I mean, even though they're dying, what I'm pointing is making even here to Pliny, he's saying, you know, the real ones, you can't make them curse if you got a gun to the head. They didn't have a gun, but they had an axe to chop their head off or put them in the fire. He said the real ones, they won't curse Christ. They'll die first. He said, now, he goes on, he said, they were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was daylight, when they sang an alternate verse, a hymn to Christ as a God, and bound themselves with a solemn oath not to do any wicked deeds, but to abstain from all fraud, theft, adultery, never to break their word, and never to deny truth when they should be called upon to deliver it up, after which was their custom to separate, and then to meet again to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. Boy, isn't that a compliment to Christians? You know, what is their crime? They meet together early in the morning, sing hymns to Christ, bound themselves to an oath to not do any wicked deeds, to abstain from fraud, theft, and adultery. And you're saying, these are model citizens. You know, these are people we need, you know, not going to fraud, mean they're going to pay their taxes. You know, they're going to do what's right. And Lucian, hostile to Christians, he said, the Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains the contempt for death and voluntary self-devotion, which are so common among them. They're not afraid to die. It was impressed on them by the original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship this crucified sage and live after his laws. Yep, that's who we are. You know, now, I find these excerpts here to be enormous validity to Christianity being what it is. It's a true historical rooted event. It's not imaginary. Somebody didn't dream it up. It's a question now whether you're going to take Pliny's position or you're going to be a part of the group. And they're guilty of, you know, what are they guilty of? They meet early in the morning and they pledge themselves to not be adulterers, not to steal, and to, and he said, you can't make a Christian curse Christ. He said, I've tried the true ones. You can't make them, no matter what you do. And they have a contempt for death because they believe they're immortal, meaning that you can kill me, but you're not going to touch my soul. Now, all right, page 5, we're not going to do it right now, but I want you to take the home with you and look at it. Now, all right. This, the end of Christianity, deeply rooted in history, outside of Christian writings. Now we're going to see the emergence of Scripture, and we'll have a couple of handouts on the emergence of Scripture. Page 5, page 6, and 7, 8, 9. We'll look at that next, 10, I guess that goes right on right there. Okay. Now, go to page 12. I want to just introduce this to you, and I want you to start looking at it. My example is that Gail held hands with her grandmother, who had held hands with a man who fought in the Civil War. Okay? So that's a pretty strong tie, right? Now, as you look at the early church fathers, now, we're going to talk about the apostolic fathers. We're going to talk about the early church fathers. The word apostolic fathers is fathers who held hand with an apostle. And look at the people here down the line. Clement of Rome, Ignatius, Papias, Polycarp. Polycarp was born in 69. The elder John died about what year? 100. Yeah. So he's out about 100. So even Justin Martyr was born at the time that John is dying. So you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these guys who held hands with a person who held hands with an apostle. Okay, no, they held hands with an apostle. The rest of these held hands with a man who held hands with an apostle. Takes you all the way down to almost Crippian origin. Okay, Julius Africanus that I mentioned just a moment ago. Now, what we will do when we get there, we will look at these people's writings and what they're writing about. Okay? Now, one of the big things we've got to fight against in today's world, 325, Constantine found out that Christianity wasn't universal in terms of in union with its thinking about the Bible, what books we read, what books we don't read, about the nature of Christ, lots of things, okay? And so people tell us that your Bible was orchestrated by Pope Constantine. He wasn't a pope, but, you know, at that time he was the emperor and he's the one that called the shots. He says, I mean, he could. He legalized Christianity and he said, you gotta get, you know, y'all come and meet at my expense. He put on a big convention at Nicaea, and I mean, it was a palace kind of area, and he fed them and took care of them for weeks, and got them there and back home and that sort of thing, and they couldn't. So, critics of Christianity tell us right now that our Bible is Constantine's Bible. Well, I want to demonstrate before we even get to Constantine, you know, where the scriptures are. And the nature of Christ, even though a council was convened in 325, 385, and 450, we're already talking about that back in 100 A.D. You know, it isn't a novel new idea. Although the council declares definitively from this point on, anyone who stands against the council is now declared to be a heretic, and you're subject to being punished. Okay. The date of the council is not the first time we talk about it. It is when it's made dogma, which is, I thought that's something a dog ate, but, it becomes authoritative at that point. And then you're no longer free to have discussion about it. It is. This is the way it is. You know, that sort of thing. Okay. I thought baling hay was tiring. Okay, I feel like my goal will get on the other end of this, and you're going to have some real foundation to appreciate your faith, understand where things are coming from, and because I'm telling you, right now we're undermining everything that happened in the first 300 years at the cost of blood. Authority of Scripture, understanding of the faith, all of it's right now, all that was hammered out for 300 years is now being, well, we need to read all these other books. We need to be reading the Gospel of Thomas. We need to read the Gospel of Peter. We need to read, you know, okay, time's up. We need to go. All right.